Prodigal Summer, Disc 5.
Chapter 9. Old Chestnuts. Garnet stood admiring the side of his barn. Over the course of a century, the unpainted chestnut planks had weathered to a rich, mottled gray, interrupted only by the orange and lime-colored streaks of lichen that brightened the wood in long vertical stripes where moisture drained from the galvanized tin roof. He was haunted by the ghosts of these old chestnuts, by the great emptiness their extinction had left in the world. And so this was something Garnet did from time to time, like going to the cemetery to be with dead relatives. He admired chestnut wood. He took a moment to honor and praise its color, its grain, and its miraculous capacity to stand up to decades of weather without pressure treatment or insecticides. Why and how, exactly, no one quite knew. There was no other wood to compare with it. A man could only thank the Lord for having graced the earth with the American chestnut, that broad-crowned, majestic source of nuts and shade and durable lumber. Garnet could recall the days when chestnuts had grown so thick on the mountaintops of this county that in spring, when the canopies burst into flower, they appeared as snow-capped peaks. Families had lived through the winter on the gunny sacks of chestnuts stored in their root cellars, and hams from the hogs they'd fattened on chestnuts, and the money they'd earned sending chestnuts by the railroad car to Philadelphia and New York City, where people of other nationalities and religious persuasions roasted them for sale on street corners. He thought of cities as being populated with those sorts of people, the types to hunker over purchased coals, roasting nuts whose origins they could only guess at. Whereas Garnet liked to think of his own forebears as chestnut people. Of chestnut logs the walkers had built their cabins until they had sons and a sawmill to rip and plane the trees into board lumber from which they then built their houses and barns and finally an empire. It was lumber sales from Walker's mill that had purchased the land and earned his grandfather the right to name Zebulon Mountain. Starting with nothing but their wits and strong hands, the Walkers had lived well under the sheltering arms of the American chestnut until the slow devastation began to unfold in 1904, the year that brought down the chestnut blight. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. That was not Garnet's to question, the fall of his family fortunes. He didn't begrudge the sales of land that by the year 1950, when the last chestnuts were gone, had whittled his grandfather's huge holdings down to a piece of bottomland too small to support anything but a schoolteacher. Garnet hadn't minded being a teacher. Ellen certainly hadn't minded being married to one. He hadn't needed to own an empire and did not resent the necessity of close neighbors, save for one. But neither did he ever doubt that his own dream, to restore the chestnut tree to the American landscape, was also a part of God's plan, which would lend to his family's history a beautiful symmetry. On his retirement from the Zebulon County school system a dozen years ago, Garnet had found himself blessed with these things: a farm with three level fields and no livestock, a good knowledge of plant breeding, a handful of seed sources for American chestnuts, and access to any number of mature Chinese chestnuts that people had planted in their yards in the wake of the blight. They had found the nuts far less satisfactory, and of course the tree itself had none of the American chestnut's graceful stature or its lumber qualities, but the Chinese chestnut had proven entirely resistant to blight. This lesser tree had been spared for a divine purpose, like some of the inferior animals on Noah's Ark. Garnet understood that on his slow march toward his heavenly reward, he would spend as many years as possible crossing and back-crossing the American with the Chinese chestnut. He worked like a driven man, haunted by his arboreal ghosts, and had been at it for nearly a decade now. If he lived long enough, he would produce a tree with all the genetic properties of the original American chestnut, except one. It would retain from its Chinese parentage the ability to stand tall before the blight. It would be called the Walker American Chestnut. He would propagate this seedling and sell it by mail order that it might go forth and multiply in the mountains and forests of Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, and all points north to the Adirondacks and west to the Mississippi. The landscape of his father's manhood would be restored. A loud buzz near his ear made Garnet turn his head and look up too fast, causing him to experience such a bout of dizziness that he nearly had to sit down on the grass. The Japanese beetles were thick as pea soup already, and it was only June. He noticed that his Concord grapevines, which he loved to see climbing lazy and lush up the slatted side of the old grain house, with their leaves drooping like ladies' hands, were showing a rusty brown aura. From this distance, it looked as if they'd been dusted with brown powder, but he knew it was really the brown skeleton of the leaf showing through. It was something he had pointed out to his VOAG students time and again, the characteristic sign of Japanese beetle damage. Something to add to his list for the hardware today. Malathion. The seven dust wasn't killing them dead enough, or it was washing off in all this rain. He glanced over toward Raleigh's, whence came the plague. She had started several new brush piles along the line fence just to gall him. She called them compost, and claimed they heated up on the inside to a temperature that would kill beetle larvae and weed seeds, but he doubted it. Any decent farmer who'd spent his life in Zebulon County learning thrifty and effective farming methods would know to set fire to his orchard trimmings, but she was too busy with her bug traps and voodoo to get rid of her tree trash the normal way. Compost piles. Laziness lots would be a better name for them. Stacks of sloth. Earlier in the week, he had attempted to speak to her over the fence. "The source of Japanese beetles seems to be your brush piles, Miss Raleigh." To which she'd replied, "Mr. Walker, the source of Japanese beetles is Japan." There was no talking to her. Why even try? He noted that her pitiful old foreign truck was gone from its usual spot between the lilac hedge and her white clapboard house. He wondered where she might have gone on a Friday morning. Saturday mornings she always went out with her produce to the Amish market, and Mondays to Kroger's. The Black store wasn't adequate to her needs, according to Oda Black, who had spied Nanny in Kroger's purchasing soya sauce. And lately she went out on Tuesday afternoons also, for a purpose he hadn't yet discerned. Sundays she went to the Unitarian place. Garnet was not about to call it a church. That was just her cup of tea, he imagined, a den of coffee-drinking women in slacks making high-toned conversation along godless lines. Evolution, transcendentalism, things of that nature. Thank goodness it was over the county line, at least, in Franklin, where they had the college. They had more of that kind over there, and as Garnet understood it, the debauchery in this state just increased at a steady pace along an eastward line that wound itself up in Washington, D.C. It was Oda Black's opinion that the Unitarian women refused to wear proper foundation garments and dabbled in witchcraft. Oda was quick to point out that she was not one to stand in judgment, though she was wide enough to stand anywhere she pleased, and no one would argue save for the floorboards. She'd heard it from somebody firsthand, and furthermore, two girls from the college had once wandered into her store talking right out loud to each other about witchcraft, not caring who heard them, while they reached into the cooler for their sodas. Oda reported that their flesh had jiggled under their T-shirts like jelly turned out of its jar. That was Franklin County for you. That college was asking for it when they let in women. Garnet stepped up onto his porch and pulled a folded square of paper from his shirt pocket. He had put a good day's work behind him, 5 hours already this morning, hand-pollinating and bagging chestnut flowers. June was his busiest month, and this morning when the sun finally came out after its long confinement, Garnet had risen early and got out into his hybrid seedling fields to make up for lost time. There was still so much to be done. The grass in his yard was high, and weeds were springing up along the creek bank, but he could postpone the mowing and weed killing until later this afternoon. Now it was past 11 o'clock, and he had earned the pleasure of a trip to town. Not that he had any kind of a joyride planned. It was mostly errands, Black Store, Tick's Garage, and Little Brother's Hardware. He unfolded the square of paper on which he'd made his list for the hardware. 1. Hacksaw blade. The last time he'd used the saw on a stripped bolt, he'd noted it was dull. 2. Black plastic for mulching between the tree rows. 3. AA flashlight batteries. 4. 3 PVC pipe fittings, L-shape, 1/2 inch, broken irrigation line. 5. Paint markers for the hybrid trees. He resented this item, since he knew he still had some markers down in the barn, but he'd wasted nearly an hour yesterday looking for them and suspected they'd been taken. Maybe by a neighbor child. Maybe by a groundhog. 6. Weed killer, 1 gallon concentrate. The resentment attached to this final purchase was boundless and only feebly expressed by his underlining and exclamation points, but he couldn't delay it any longer. He had to face Oda Black every time he needed bread, Miracle Whip, and bologna, and he knew how they must be tarring and feathering him down there at the store behind his back. "Here comes the county's worst road frontage," Oda probably cried when his truck pulled up out front, chuckling as she shoved herself up from her armchair by the front window and slid her swollen feet toward the register. "Shh, everybody, it's Mr. Pokeweed." All right, then, he would spray his front bank himself. Bring that forest of briars crashing down around the ears of the snapping turtles. Garnet still turned red to think about it. At least Oda didn't seem to have heard about the turtle. He added malathion, for Japanese beetles, to his list, refolded the paper, replaced it in his shirt pocket, and went into the house, comforting himself with thoughts of Pinky's diner. In the front hallway, he paused to sort through a stack of mail he had brought in yesterday but forgotten to look at. Advertisement circulars, nonsense, not even a bill. He slid the whole lot into the trash and closed the west-facing window in the kitchen against the heat that would arrive this afternoon in his absence. After his errands, he would go to Pinky's for the fish dinner special that was offered every Friday afternoon. All the fried catfish you could eat with hush puppies and slaw, $5.99. Garnet suspected that since Pinky's had it on Fridays, it was probably meant for the Catholics. But the diner was a place of business, after all, not a church. Catholics in Zebulon County were few and far between, and anyhow, Pinky Prater would accept $5.99 from a dog or a horse if it came in, and put it in his cash register with no questions asked. Pinky's on Fridays was a settled matter in Garnet's mind. In fact, on the rare Friday when he failed to keep his appointment with the fish dinner special, rumors about Garnet Walker's health circulated so fast that when he turned up next at Black Store or the filling station, people were amazed to see him alive. No matter, a predictable mare beats a wild hare, his father used to say. Pinky's was Garnet's only extravagance, and he liked to look forward to it. He did not tend to eat well since his wife had died. It had been enough years now that he'd gotten used to cold meat sandwiches for dinner and a single placemat on the table, but he had never learned to cook. Certainly not something like a hush puppy. How would you even begin to make a hush puppy? What in the world was in one? Nothing to do with a puppy, surely. Garnet had long known, though he didn't much like to admit it, that God's world and the better part of daily life were full of mysteries known only to women. He would have to change his shirt before starting out. He had broken a sweat out there in the field, to say the least. He closed the bathroom door, though he lived alone and never had guests, and took off his shirt without looking in the bathroom mirror. After he had washed himself with a cloth, he went to his bedroom bureau to retrieve his last clean undershirt, tomorrow was laundry day, and to the armoire to take down his town shirt from its hanger. It smelled slightly of Pinky's fish dinner specials. He would remember to wash it tomorrow, Even though this would also mean fussing with the iron, he had never learned to make it hiss out steam the way Ellen could. Only after he had buttoned the collar and tucked in the tails did he allow himself a glance in Ellen's dressing mirror. There was nothing wrong with his bare chest, beyond an old man's slightly sunken ribs and an odd nest of white hair in the middle, but modesty was Garnet's habit. He had been a widower for 8 years. He kept company with his god. His body was no longer to be looked upon. If the thought caused him sadness, that he would never again know the comfort of human touch, he sensed it was merely a tributary to the lake of grief through which an old man must swim at the end of his days. He gathered up his ring of keys, counted the cash in his wallet, and locked the kitchen door on his way out. He stole another glance over toward Nanny's, noticing with surprise a large, roughly cow-shaped patch of darkness on her roof. He walked a bit closer and squinted through the tops of his bifocals. It was a patch of the green shingles missing. They must have blown off in the last storm. What a mess that must be in all this rain, and what a nuisance to replace. Worse than a nuisance, those old hand-cut shingles were impossible to find nowadays. She would have to redo the whole roof if she didn't want it to look hodgepodge. He touched the corners of his mouth, trying not to harbor pleasure at a neighbor's misfortune. She did not know that in Garnet's own garage there was a stack of those green shingles from the original lot that Garnet's father and old man Raleigh had ordered together and shared. Originally, before Garnet had modernized to asbestos in the 1960s, the two houses had borne the same style of clapboard and the same spade-shaped shingles. Garnet's father had been on good enough terms with old man Raleigh that he'd sold him the 55 acres of orchard land with only the one decent house site, which put the Raleighs near enough by to hit with a rock, as the saying went, though no one had ever felt that particular urge until Garnet and Nanny. The house was modest, neat, and small, with its hipped roof and gables facing the road. Old Raleigh was a good orchard man who'd planted excellent stock. But anyone could have foreseen that his daughter stood to inherit, since he had no sons. That was trouble that Garnet's father should have smelled. A daughter away at school in the 1950s. Before you could say Jack Robinson, she'd be back here parading around in loud clothes, having an illegitimate child with mental deficiencies, and making up her mind to grow apples with no chemicals whatsoever, in flat defiance of the laws of nature. Garnet sighed and forgave his father once again. It was not a premeditated crime, only a failure of foresight. As successor to a lost fortune, Garnet had spent his life glancing away from visions of how things might have turned out differently. Nanny Raleigh was the exception. How could he not dwell on her presence in his life and seek its meaning? Garnet had overlooked her as a child. She was a kid, maybe 10 years younger. Had hardly known her as a young woman, since she was away for so many years, and had mainly ignored her as long as his wife was alive. Ellen liked to have little chit-chats with her and then disapprove afterward. But now, during these 8 years alone, he'd been forced to bear her as a burgeoning plague on his old age. Why? What made Nanny do the things she did, before God and man and sometimes on Garnet's property? He suspected a connection between that long-ago birth of a deformed child and her terror of chemicals. The troubles had been evident at birth, the Mongol features and so forth, and Nanny had named it Rachel Carson Raleigh, after that lady scientist who cried wolf about DDT. Everything in Nanny's life since seemed to turn on the birth of that child, now that he looked back. The woman had probably been normal once. That child had launched her off the deep end. Where would she be now on a Friday? She never went out on Fridays. He ducked behind his Rose of Sharon and peered around the back of her house to make sure the truck wasn't parked back there. Sometimes she parked in the back if she had something to unload. Last week she had parked inside her barn with a load of apple crates piled high in the truck bed. But today there was no sign of her. He climbed into his own truck, a 1986 Ford pickup, which started right up. He had cleaned and gapped the spark plugs last week, and steered carefully out onto number 6, purposefully ignoring his disgraceful frontage. Soon enough, soon enough. He needed more 2,4-D and Roundup both for the seedling fields, and had neglected to order them wholesale from the company as he had in previous years. He drove very slowly, taking his time with the curves. Garnet did realize his eyesight wasn't what it could have been. This was not something he refused to admit. But there was very little traffic on 6 anymore, since they'd made that interstate down King Valley. Anyone who had any business on this road would recognize Garnet's truck. They'd know to give him a wide berth. It wasn't as if he were blind, for heaven's sake. He just had some trouble judging distance. There had been a few mishaps. He would go to Little Brother's first, then circle around to the filling station to top off the tank of his truck and use the air hose to clean his air filter, two things he did each and every Friday. Today he would also need to buy 5 gallons of diesel for his tractor, since he would soon have cultivating to do. After his dinner at Pinky's, he would stop at Blackstore on the way home. That was it. Blackstore should be the last thing, lest the milk curdle in his truck on this warm day and the eggs incubate and hatch. He passed by Blackstore just then, at the intersection of 6 and Egg Creek Road, though he didn't see Oda wave at him through the window. Images from Garnet's past always lurked and rose up from the ditches as he drove this road, pictures more real to him than the things in plain view. A wild grapevine that had climbed into his mother's arborvitae, covering its rounded top like a shiny green leather hunting cap. A sport groundhog, blonde as wheat, with a black tail and cap, that lived under their barn for a season. All of the children had seen it before their father did, for what do children have to do in their lives but look for sport groundhogs? Father did not believe in its existence until nearly the end of the summer, when he finally saw it too. Then it was real. He told neighbors about it then. The children felt proud when he did, as if they too had become more real. As Garnet navigated Highway 6, he breathed the air of that other time. A clearer time, it seemed, when colors and sound were more distinct and things tended to remain where they belonged. When the bobwhite quail could be counted on to cry his name pensively from the fields of an afternoon. Whatever happened to the bobwhite? You never heard him anymore. Garnet had read something from the extension about fescues being the cause, the ordinary fescue grass people planted for hay. It grew too densely for the bobwhite chicks to find their way through. Garnet could remember when fescue hay was the latest thing and the government was paying farmers to convert their fields from their native grasses to this new kind from Europe or somewhere fancy. They'd thought kudzu was a great idea back then, too. Lordy. Now fescue was everywhere, and probably no one but Garnet even remembered the bunch grasses that used to grow here naturally, the blue stem and such. It must seem strange to the animals to have a new world entire sprouting all around them, replacing what they'd known. What a sadness, the baby quails lost in that jungle with nowhere to go. But you had to have hay. Now here was Grandy's bait store, not a memory but a fact, with its hand-lettered sign, Lizards 10 for a dollar. It perturbed him slightly that people in Zebulon County could not learn to call a salamander what it was, but it perturbed him more that Nanny Raleigh stopped in there at least once a month, bought every lizard in the tank, and set them all free behind her orchard in Egg Creek. Everyone knew she did it. Boys seined them and sold them to Dennis Grandy for a penny apiece, laughing all the way, knowing full well that most would be set free again by Nanny Raleigh. Why did everyone suffer her so merrily? She claimed there were 10 or 15 kinds of salamanders in Zebulon that were endangered species, and said she was doing her part to save the environment. Implying what, then? That anyone who went bass fishing with salamanders was an enemy of God's plan? Garnet would like to tell her a thing or two about God's plan. That the creatures of this earth came to pass and sometimes passed on. That these matters were not ours to control if we were, as she claimed, merely one more species among our brethren, the animals. And if we were not the equal of animals, if we were meant instead to be masters and keepers of Eden, as the Bible said, then lizards were put here for a man to go bass fishing with, and that was that. She couldn't have it both ways. It was all quite clear to Garnet. Yet his logic always cowered before her curt and snappy replies. He had actually thought once or twice of writing her a letter. He drove past the Pentecostal church, which had a spindly clump of Joe Pieweed sprouting up in its parking lot. Oh-ho, too busy speaking in tongues and throwing their babies to get out and weed their parking lot. Garnet smiled, feeling secure in his understanding of what God's word did and did not mean to suggest. He felt a slight press of guilt then, as he steered his truck onto Maple. He ought to tell Miss Raleigh about those shingles in his garage. If only she were the least bit reasonable. There was the bank, there was the Esso. He was in town now. There was Les Pratt, who'd taught math at the high school when Garnet taught vocational agriculture. He waved, but Les was on the wrong side of the street. There was Dennis Grandy's wife with all those children, who weren't exactly dirty, but never seemed quite clean. And there was Nanny Raleigh, her truck, anyway. Dear merciful heavens, could he not get away from her for at least one pleasant trip into town? That woman was stubborn as cockleburrs and a rash of poison ivy. He slowed down to get a better look. It was her truck, parked in the Baptist church lot where they let the Amish set up their farmer's market on Saturdays. This was Friday, though. Yet it was them, all right, the Amish children in their sober black dresses and trousers, politely selling their produce. He didn't see Nanny. He would maneuver his truck around the block and come back for a second look. Were there so many Amish now that they had to have markets on Saturdays and Fridays? They were a burgeoning people, that much he knew. They'd taken over a long row of farms on the other side of the river he'd noticed last year. How were they managing so nicely when every other farmer in the county was selling off his hayfields for house lots and looking for factory work? Well, the Amish weren't in debt up to their ears on chemicals and equipment, which gave them an unfair advantage, Garnet supposed. Oh! He missed a stop sign, then slammed on the brakes a hair too late, but it was all right. The car got around him. For quite a while, he'd wondered about those farms along the river, which were unreachable by car and accessible only by swinging bridges, long, narrow ones made of planks with just cables for handrails. It would take some courage to cross that gorge every day. He'd wondered how on earth a man would get his television or his wife's refrigerator over there, or even a tractor, to a farm like that. Then Les Pratt had told him the answer in a single word, Amish. He rounded the corner and took another look at the Amish market. It was tempting to stop. He used to go nearly every Saturday before Nanny started showing up there with her apples or, in the early season like now, her apple blossom honey and basil dazzle and whatnot for sale. Evidently, you didn't have to be Amish. They shared the space with Nanny and a handful of other farmers from the upper end of the county. The only rule was that everything had to be organic. The Amish didn't use any poisons, which seemed all right to Garnet if it was a religious matter. But Nanny's presence among them had settled it. He couldn't set foot in the place once she became part of it, for now it was organic, capital O, with its placid, irritating sense of holier than thou. So, no more stopping by on Saturday mornings to buy a delicious fresh pie and stand among these innocent youngsters with their neat stacks of vegetables, preserves, and rabbits. He missed them, he realized sadly, recognizing the same small ache that came when he thought of his boy's face in innocent childhood, his own son, barefoot with a fishing pole, the terrible mistakes all lying ahead of him still. Garnet missed hearing the Amish children count out his change in an accent that seemed vaguely foreign, while he covertly looked at their feet, which were thickly calloused, for they wore no shoes all summer long. He knew the Amish didn't send their children to school, and technically he disapproved of what they called godly simplicity, actually simple backwardness. Yet he had a soft spot for those boys and girls. He wondered why the adults sent the children to town to do their selling. Were the adults elsewhere in town on other business, making the small spare purchases they must surely need to make, a rake, some kerosene, something like that, he imagined. Did they feel the children would make better emissaries for representing their kind? Was it a play for sympathy? It seemed to run against their habit of isolation, Garnet thought. Letting these children come into town to watch other families pile out of station wagons, to see other children play with radios or the electronic thingamajigs they all carried in their pockets now while their mothers idly handled the melons. What were those Amish children learning to want that they could never have? Half a block up from the market, he slowed and pulled his truck into a parking spot on the side of the street. He sat for a while, considering his alternatives. He could go and buy a pie. They had the most wonderful pies. Apple, cherry, and something they called shoe fly. But where in heaven's name was Nanny Raleigh? Her truck was there, and in front of it was a table with her kinds of things, the frills she'd gotten into when apples were out of season, lemon basil, lavender sachets, dried flowers, the sorts of things he considered so unnecessary that it embarrassed him to look at them. Where was she? He would walk down to the end of the block and do his errands at Little Brother's, he decided. On the walk back, if the coast was clear, he would buy a pie. He would try to find one particular boy he remembered, with the stiff Dutch boy haircut and the rabbits in a cage. He'd chatted with that young fellow and given him some advice about poultry. Ezra, that boy was. Or Ezekiel? Garnet mounted the concrete steps to Little Brother's with a light and steady heart, but things did not go well from that point on. Right on the threshold, where Dink Little greeted him by name, he realized he'd forgotten his list. He patted his shirt pocket, ready to whip it out with a flourish in answer to Dink's predictable, "What y'all need today?" Then he patted his other pocket. But he'd changed his shirt, of course. "I just need to look around a minute, Dink," Garnet replied, feeling sure he could quickly reconstruct his list as soon as he saw one of the items on the shelf. But he saw nothing he needed here. The musty, high-ceilinged store suddenly seemed more like an attic than a place of commerce. Tall stacks of galvanized buckets leaned this way and that. Mops leaned lazily against shelves full of floor polish. Stacks of green work gloves reached out toward him like a host of dismembered hands. He staggered sideways around a display of lawnmowers on sale and bumped his head on the sign above them that was so large and colorful it gave him a headache even without his reading it. "June mower sale, 10% off all brands. Toro, Green Machine, Snapper, John Deere." Garnet felt so rattled he could hardly stand up. He set his sights on a wheelbarrow down at the end of an aisle and headed for it just to get himself away from the door and the register, out of sight, where he could think. If he took his time, he would remember. Weed killer, of course. Roundup, 1 gallon concentrate. He almost laughed aloud. It was coming back. Roundup, Malathion, and paint markers for the trees, which he really shouldn't buy. He had some in the barn. "Now, does it sound like more of a whine or more of a buzz? Because when the gearing pops out of whack, it'll do that on you." One of the brothers up at the register was chatting with a customer. That would be Big, or Marshall. Dink always stayed by the door. "What I'm saying is I didn't even hear it," the customer argued. "I turned my back and it ran off down the hill." Weed killer and Malathion. He spied a bottle of Malathion on a shelf midway down the aisle past the galvanized buckets. Even though it was a spray bottle and not the size he needed, he walked over and seized it for courage. He was an old man lost in a hardware store, missing the fine print on all he surveyed. He needed to arm himself. What else had been on that list? "They don't make 'em any bigger than that or any meaner. Just a monster, and you'll have to take my word for it," the customer said.
"Well, Big here's the expert on Big," said Marshall.
"Now, you boys aren't listening to me," the voice said coyly. The brothers were laughing to beat the band, but Garnet's heart skipped a beat. He knew that voice. Good Lord in heaven, was he meant to suffer like Job? It was Nanny Raleigh. Garnet stood next to the wheelbarrow at the end of the aisle, listening.
How could she be here when she'd been down the street selling frou-frou at the Amish market 10 minutes ago? Was she one of those Unitarian witches whizzing around Egg Fork on a broomstick? He leaned forward and peered around a stack of galvanized buckets, looking for an escape path. He could just leave, go home, get his list, and come back in half an hour. There would still be time for fish dinner afterwards. Pinky stayed open till 4. But there was no way out. The register was near the front door, and that was where she was, holding court, making her ridiculous small talk with Dink, Big, and Marshall. He nearly covered his ears, so unbearable was that voice to him. However entertaining it might be proving at the moment to the indolent little brothers, they were laughing like a pack of hyenas. "Not a snapper!" one of them cried. "Yes, a snapper!" she replied, sounding both indignant and amused. Garnet sat down in the wheelbarrow and held his head in his hands. This was too much to bear. This was beyond even what he expected of Nanny Raleigh, whose sole claim on any kind of decency was that she was generally not a rumor-monger. "Law, I think I'd have had to seen that to believe it," said Marshall, practically doubled over with amusement. How could she do this to Garnet, her own good neighbor? How dared she ridicule him in public over that business with the snapping turtle, when the whole thing had been her fault? "It was her fault," he said faintly, much too faintly to be heard, from his undignified post in the wheelbarrow. "Her weeds." They were still braying like donkeys as they rang up her purchases. Did it take all 3 littles to ring up a blessed purchase? They were acting like schoolboys, making over her as if she were some beauty queen instead of a backbiting hag in a calico skirt. She had this whole town under her spell. Now she was asking for their advice about roofing compounds. Was there to be no end to this torment? Apparently she meant to stand there flirting all day until Pinky's diner closed and the chickens went home to roost. Garnet was going to have to march past them. This became clear. Suddenly, all he could do was picture himself safely home at his kitchen table, reading the farm news in the paper. That was where he wanted to be, more desperately than he desired any love or grace on this earth or beyond it. Home. He wouldn't even go to Pinky's. There was no point now. It was all you can eat, and he'd lost his appetite. Garnet stood tall and marched toward the door, holding his spray bottle of malathion in front of him to clear the path. They turned to stare as he stalked wordlessly and with great dignity past the counter. "Why, Mr. Walker!" she cried. "Well, howdy-do to you," he thought. "There you are, caught in your tracks, you old biddy, you and your gossip-mongering friends. Let your sins keep you awake at night." He nearly knocked his head a second time on the June mower sale sign, but remembered to duck, praise Jesus, in the nick of time. He found his truck and was 2 blocks down the street past the Amish market before his heart stopped pounding in his ears. And he was beyond Black Store, halfway up Route 6 to his house, somewhere in front of Nanny Raleigh's farm frontage, when it occurred to him that her lawnmower was a snapper. Her mower that he knew had been giving her trouble, which she'd purchased at Little Brother's. A snapper. He was parked in his own driveway before he realized he had shoplifted a bottle of malathion. Chapter 10. Moth Love. Swallows looped and dived inside the barn, swooping from their nests in the rafters overhead toward the doorway and out into the bright purple evening, where the low sun glinted off their streamlined, back-curved wings. They were like little fighter planes, angry at any intrusion, expressing their ire in motion like bullets. Every evening, Lusa came into the barn to milk, and every evening the swallows responded this way. Like some people, she thought, short on sense, long on ambition. Sunset canceled all previous gains, and the world was good for a fresh fight every day. Her thoughts trailed off into a kind of trance as she milked and watched the barn swallows make their repetitious oval flights out over the flat surface of the pond, which the sunset had laminated with gold leaf.
Suddenly she jumped, startling the cow. Little Ricky was standing in the doorway, all 6.5 feet of him. "Hey, Ricky, how's it going?" He ambled toward the stanchion where she sat on a stool, working the udder to its end. Down here in the cellar of the barn where the stalls were, the roof was low. Little Ricky's head nearly touched the rafters. "Good, I reckon." "Well, good. How's your family?" Ricky cleared his throat. "Fine, I guess. Dad sent me up to tell you we won't be setting tobacco on Saturday. Tomorrow, I guess he means." "No?" She looked up at him. "Why not? The ground is drying out. I walked out there on the tobacco bottom this afternoon, and it's not that bad. In fact, I called down there to tell him everything looked good for tomorrow, but nobody was home. I think the rain's really stopped, finally." Ricky looked as if he'd rather be anywhere in the county, pretty much, than in this barn talking with Lusa. A family trait. "Well, Uncle Herb said he's got real busy with his calves, and Dad said you wasn't all that interested in us setting your tobacco anyways, is what they said." "Oh, I see. I'm supposed to go down there and apologize for my rash attempt at self-rule and beg them on bended knee to come set my tobacco." She saw she was being punished. The tobacco had been their idea, and now they were using it against her. Lusa put her shaking hands on her knees to force some calm into herself. Her sudden anger had upset the cow enough to stop her milk for the moment. There was nothing doing until she let down again. Cows were a lesson in patience. Ricky shrugged his shoulders inside his jean jacket, that particular movement owned by teenage boys trying to fit their adult bodies. She shouldn't speak her mind to this kid, she realized. He must already consider her a hysteric. A redhead, Cole used to say. The boy kept a nervous eye on Lusa while he shook a cigarette out of his pack and lit it. As an afterthought, he held out the pack to her, but she shook her head. "No thanks, I don't smoke, which is a misdemeanor in this county, I gather." He ran a hand through his thick black hair. "I don't think Dad and them is wanting you to get on your knees and beg them or nothing." "No," she said. "I'm sorry for snapping. I didn't mean that literally." "Anyways, it wouldn't matter if you did, since Dad didn't get sets from Jackie Doddard. There's probably none left in the whole county by now, I don't reckon." "Oh, well, I guess that settles it. My goose is cooked." She returned her hands to the cow's udder and manipulated it gently to submission. There was no sound in the barn but the rhythmic ring of the milk stream against the metal bucket and the syncopated, soggy-sounding drips from the waterlogged joists where the roof had leaked. Every drip reminded Lusa of the barn-fixing money she didn't have and now would not earn from tobacco.
"Got some leaks," Ricky said, looking up.
"About $3,000 worth, I'm guessing. Maybe more, once they get into those rotten roof beams."
"Hay's gonna spoil."
"Oh, don't worry about that. I probably won't even get any hay mowed or put up in the barn this summer. The baler's broken down, and the tractor's probably going to be repossessed. I was thinking I'd just let the cows eat snow this year." Little Ricky stared at her. His big body was a cool 17, but his face looked younger. What was wrong with her? Why was she venting her ironic wrath on this child? He was only the messenger. She was shooting the messenger.
"Hey," he said, "I'm real sorry about, you know, Uncle Cole."
"Thank you. Me too," she exhaled slowly. "It hasn't even been a month. 27 days. Seems like 27 years. He repositioned himself against one of the massive old chestnut posts that held up the upper floor of the barn. Upstairs, where they hung the tobacco, the barn was lofty as a cathedral. But down here, where the animals stayed, it was friendly and close with the sweet, mixed smells of grain, manure, and milk.
"Me and Uncle Cole used to go fishing. He ever tell you about that? We'd skip school together and go trout fishing up on Zeb Mountain. Man, it's pretty up there. They got trees so big you just about fall over from looking at 'em."
"You'd skip school together?" Lusa considered this. "When you were in first or second grade, Cole was still in high school. I never even thought about that. He was your pal, like a big brother?"
"Yeah."
Ricky looked down.
being careful where he put his cigarette ash. He always told me stuff, how to talk to girls and stuff. Lusa raised the heel of her hand against one eye and turned away, unprepared to cry in front of Ricky. Yeah, that was one thing he sure knew how to do. The cow lowed, a small protest in the dripping silence. Her calf in the neighboring stall immediately began to bawl, as if he'd just woken up to the injustice of milk robbery.
Milking, huh? Ricky noted.
Yep.
Looks like you're good at it.
Cole taught me. He said I had a talent. Stupid thing to be good at, right?
Not really. Animals, you know. They can tell what's what. You can't fool them like you can people.
The calf next door was still bawling, and she crooned to calm him. Hush now, your mama will be there in a minute. He quieted, and Lusa returned to the milking. There was comfort in this work. Sometimes she felt flooded with the mental state of her Jersey cow, a humble, unsurprised wonder at the fact of still being here in this barn at the end of each day. Lusa actually enjoyed the company. She'd been tempted to name her, until Cole pointed out that they were going to eat her child.
Uncle Herb over at his dairy? Him and the cows is like oil and water, he says. He does all the milking with machines. Hooks up Bossy to the tank and sucks her dry.
Yikes, poor Bossy.
I don't think they mind it none. They're just cows.
True.
How many times a day you milk her? Twiced?
Twiced, they all said. Onced, twiced. She wondered if that was a vestige of old English hanging on in these isolated mountain towns. I just milk once a day, believe it or not. Even that's more than I need now. Just before you came in that door, I was making up my mind for this to be my last milking.
Yeah?
Yeah. Tomorrow, I'm pasturing this girl out with her calf so all that milk can go to the stomach it was made for. It doesn't do much for mine.
Don't care for milk, do you?
It doesn't care for me. I did this for Cole because he loved fresh cream. I like making yogurt, lavanzavati. I'll miss that. But I've frozen enough butter and cheese to last me all winter, and fresh milk I just don't need.
Unless your family wants it? Nah, we get a gallon a day from Uncle Herb. We drink it, too. Mostly I do.
Well, good for you. I wasn't raised on it like you were. Lusa was finished. She opened the stanchion to release the cow's head and carefully backed her out of it. The gentle old Jersey ambled straight to the stall that held her calf, and Lusa let her in, giving her broad flank one good pat for goodbye. She felt ridiculous for the tears in her eyes.
Yeah, Mom said you were something.
She thinks I'm something, does she?
That's nice.
Lusa brushed off her jeans and shook bits of hay out of the tails of her stained white work shirt, which reached to her knees. It was one of Cole's, pulled on over a rust-colored velvet t-shirt she used to feel pretty in, once.
No, I mean some nationality.
I knew what you meant, Ricky. Everybody's some nationality.
Not me. I'm just American.
Is that why you've got a rebel flag on the bumper of your truck? Because the Confederacy tried to bust up the American government, you know.
A Southern American, then. What are you?
That's a good question. Polish-Arab American, I guess.
Huh. You don't look it.
No? What do I look like to you? She stood under the light, holding her arms out straight against the planks of the stanchion. Her hair was curly and wild in this humidity, a strawberry blonde halo around her face in the harsh light. Small white moths batted circles around the light bulb overhead. Ricky inspected her politely.
You look like a white person, he said.
My mom's parents were Palestinian, and my dad's were Jews from Poland. I'm the black sheep of your family, and for all that, I still sunburn like nobody's business. Just goes to show you, Ricky, you can't tell a book by its cover. I heard Mom and Aunt Mary Edna talking about that you were one of those other Christianities. I can just imagine that conversation. She picked up the flathead shovel to clean up the floor of the milking parlor, but Ricky took it out of her hands, excusing himself for bumping her shoulder. She never knew how to take these country kids, rudeness and politeness in an unfathomable mix. He scraped the manure into a small pile and carried it, a shovelful at a time, to the mound just outside the door.
"It wasn't nothing against you, Aunt Lusa," he said from the darkness, giving her a jolt.
It had been so long since she'd heard her name spoken aloud. 28 days, exactly. Nobody else in the family ever said it. Ricky ducked back into the bright milking parlor.
"It was just one time when they were just talking about what if you and Uncle Cole had kids. This was before
he died, when kids were more of an option for us."
"Yeah. I think they just wondered, you know, how the church part would work. That it would be hard on his kids."
She gathered up the bucket and rag she'd used to wash the jerseys udder and set the lid onto the stainless steel milking bucket. The rim felt warm. "It wasn't hard on me, being mix and match," she said. "I'll grant you we weren't really devout either way. My dad hated his father and kind of turned his back on his religion. And I'm not a good Muslim, that's for sure. If I were, you'd see me turning..." She rotated slowly in the barn cellar, finding east. "That way, and kneeling down to pray 5 times a day.
"You pray towards the chicken house?"
"Toward Mecca."
"Where's that at, North Carolina?"
She laughed. "Saudi Arabia. It's where the Prophet Muhammad was born. So you send your prayers in his direction. And you have to wash your hands first, too."
Now Ricky looked amused. "You wash your hands before you pray?"
"Listen, you haven't seen religious. You're not supposed to touch alcohol or cigarettes, and women cover themselves up totally, all but their eyes."
She held her hands in front of her face, peering through her fingers.
"If a man sees a woman's foot, even, or her shape, it'll lead him to impure thoughts, see? And it's all her fault."
"Man, that's harsh. I thought Aunt Mary Edna was harsh. You believe in that?"
"Do I look like it?" "No, my mom never even wore the veil. Her parents were already pretty westernized when they left Gaza, but I have cousins who do."
"Yeah?"
"Yep. The American version is a scarf and a long raincoat. I'd always have to do that whenever we went to the mosque with Mom's relatives in New York." His eyes widened.
"You've been to New York City?"
She wondered what that place was in his mind. As far from the truth as this barn was in the minds of her Bronx cousins.
100 times, she said.
"My parents both came from there. We always tried to go back for their family's holidays. I think the deal on religion between Mom and Dad was that we'd skip the guilt and punishment stuff and celebrate the holidays. Feasts, basically." Lusa smiled, thinking of boy cousins and music and reckless dancing among lawn chairs in a small backyard. Festivals of love and fitting in. "I grew up on the best food you can imagine."
"Huh. I thought people that didn't believe in God just mostly worshiped the devil and stuff." "Whoa, Ricky!"
She laughed weakly, sitting back down on her milking stool.
"Don't you think there might be a couple of options in between?"
He shrugged, embarrassed.
"Maybe."
This was her cue, surely, to shrug this boy off and shoo him home. But then what? Wait for Cole to explain her to this family? Her body ached with the burden of her aloneness. Nobody was going to do this for her. She pressed her folded hands between her knees and looked up at him. "Who are you saying doesn't believe in God? Jews believe in God. Muslims believe in God. To tell the truth, most Jewish people and all Muslims I know spend more time thinking about God than you do around here. And definitely less of their church time on gossip."
"But different gods, right? Not the real one. Not ourn."
"Yes, yourn. Same exact God. His technical name is Jehovah. All 3 factions concur on that. There's just some disagreement about which son did or did not inherit the family goods. The same old story."
"Huh,"
he remarked. "Do you know that most of the people in the world are actually not Christians, Ricky?"
"Is that really true?"
He grinned sideways like a schoolboy trapped by a trick question, then lit another cigarette to recover his dignity, raising his eyebrows in a question to make sure it was okay.
"Sure, go ahead." "Can you say something in Jewish?"
Maybe you mean Yiddish or Polish?
Yeah, something in a language.
Between Yiddish and Polish, I'm not good for much. My bubala lived with us before she died, my dad's mother. But she was, like, classified. Dad wouldn't let her speak anything but English in our house. Wait, though, let me think. She rehearsed the phrase in her mind, then recited aloud.
Kannst mir blusen kalte Milch in Tuches?
What's that mean?
You can blow cold milk up my ass.
He laughed loudly.
Your mamma taught you that?
She was a pissed off old lady. Her husband ran off with a Kochet girl in a nightclub. You should ask me about Arabic. My mom taught me a bunch of things.
Okay, what's one?
Ru'uh shum hawa. It means go sniff the wind. Bug off, in other words.
Ru'uh shum hawa, he
repeated, with dreadful inflection. But Lusa was touched by his effort. His willingness to stand here and talk with her about foreign things.
Yeah, roughly, she said. That's pretty good.
Ricky smirked a little.
So,
he said, exhaling smoke. Did you have other Christmases where you'd get presents and stuff?
Other Christmases, other Easters, yeah.
It wasn't so much about presents, but definitely about food. Ramadan, that's a whole month where you don't eat during the daytime, only at night.
No kidding? You'd go all day?
Supposed to. We usually didn't. I'd just skip breakfast and try to be good for a month. But the best part is the end, where you have this giant feast to make up for everything you didn't eat that month.
Like Thanksgiving?
Better than that. It lasts 3 days, not even counting the leftovers.
Man, a pig out.
A goat out is what it is. My family was nicks on pork on both sides. Jews and Muslims agree on that. But we love goat. People think lamb's the Middle Eastern thing, but the real true tradition is Kozi Makhshi, milk-fed kid. Mom and I would always go visit the Arab cousins for Eid al-Fitr at the end of Ramadan, and they'd roast a kid over this giant spit in their backyard. Then there's another feast 4 months later, Eid al-Adha, which requires an even bigger goat.
I don't think I'd care for goat.
No? You ever eaten it?
Nuh-uh.
You don't know what you're missing. Kozi Makhshi, yum. It's like a sweet, tender calf, only better. He looked doubtful. Hey, I thought you raised goats, Ricky. What are those things with horns I've seen back behind your house?
Oh, that was a 4-H project.
And you didn't eat your project at the end?
Nah, they're just there to keep down the weeds, I reckon.
Are they for milk, theoretically, or for meat?
They're supposed to be slaughter goats. The idea was to sell them at the state fair while they were still under 40 pounds or something. The judges feel their ribs and hip bones and everything and give you a grade.
And did your goats make the honor roll?
They were pretty good, but you can't sell a goat around here. Heck, you can't give away a goat around here. I know, because I tried.
But I've seen them all over the place. Here, in this county, I mean.
Well, see, there was this big slaughter goat craze a while back in 4-H. Mr. Walker got people started on it for some reason, and now half the backfields in the county are full of goats people can't give away.
Huh, Lucy said. Who's Mr. Walker?
He's uncles or cousins to us some ways, by marriage.
Everybody within 16 miles of here is uncles or cousins to you some ways.
Yeah, but Mr. Walker, he's the livestock advisor for 4-H, or used to be when I was a little kid. He's probably retired now. He's got that farm over on number 6 that's all weedy in front. He grows chestnut trees, I heard.
Chestnut trees all died 50 years ago, Ricky. The American chestnut went extinct due to a fungal blight.
I know, but that's what people say he's growing. I don't know. He knows all this stuff about plants. Everybody said he should have been the crop project advisor, not the livestock advisor. That's why he screwed up all these kids on the goats.
Huh, Lucy said. You think he could help me find a cheap goat or two for a feast?
What the hell? I'd even invite your mom and aunts up, scandalize the family with Kozi Makhshi and Imam Biyirdi.
What's that?
Food of the gods, Ricky. Roast goat and roast stuffed vegetables. Actually, Imam Biyirdi means the emperor fainted. which is what your Aunt Mary Edna would do if she saw a goat looking at her from the middle of her mother's walnut dining table. Ricky laughed. He had a wonderful laugh, wide open, the kind that showed molars.
You don't need Mr. Walker to find you a goat. You could just run you an ad in the paper. Wanted, free goats, you deliver. I swear, Aunt Lusa, you'd look out your window next morning and see 100 goats out there eating your field.
You think?
I swear.
Well, they'd keep the thistles and briars from taking over my hay fields. I could get rid of my cows. Then I wouldn't have to learn how to run the bush hog.
That's a fact. They would keep your briars eat down. They don't take much hay either. They can feed themselves pretty good off the brush most of the winter.
Are you serious? My God, then I wouldn't even have to run my baler or put up hay. That's the best idea I've heard all day.
You need some hay, he cautioned, for when it gets bad, just not so much.
He lit another cigarette from the one that was still burning. She walked over and took the pack from him. Can I try this?
Go ahead. Gives you cancer.
I think I heard about that. She gave a small, mirthless laugh, peering into the hole in the pack. I'll tell you, though, hanging on to extra years in my 70s doesn't seem high on my list right now. Under the circumstances. She extracted one white tube and stared at it. It smelled like coal. I can't even get excited about seeing 30, to tell you the truth.
That's how kids in high school feel. That's why we all smoke.
Interesting. She put it in her mouth and leaned toward his lighter, which he pulled away, teasing her.
Is this really your first time?
Yep, you're corrupting an old lady. She tried to inhale the tip of the flame, but her throat recoiled and she coughed. Ricky laughed. She waved a hand in front of her face. I'm no good at this, obviously.
It stinks, it really does. You shouldn't start, Aunt Lusa.
She laughed. You're sweet, Ricky. Thanks for looking out for me. He met her gaze for a second. He was a striking young man, a handsome union of his father's dark complexion and the Widener looks. Lusa was seized and simultaneously mortified by thoughts of his bare chest and arms, of putting her head there and being held by him. What, was she losing her mind? Was this celibacy, lunacy, or what? She glanced down at her tennis shoes. I don't really want to die, she said, a little shaky. I don't mean to sound like that. I'm depressed, but I think that's normal for a widow. They say it passes. I was more just thinking that if tobacco's the lifeblood of this county, I should support the project.
Nah, you don't have to.
He dragged and puffed away, making tiny whistling sounds with his cigarette. He looked at her sideways. Aunt Lusa, I hope you'll take this the right way, but you're no old lady. These guys at school, friends of mine, they seen you at Kroger's and they said you were pretty hot.
Me?
She blushed scarlet. No offense, he said.
None taken.
I know, you and Cole used to skip school together and he taught you how to sweet-talk girls. I keep forgetting I'm not your mother.
He grinned and shook his head. You are not my mother.
Thank you, Lusa said primly, feeling a little guilty for all the names she'd called Ricky's mother in her mind. Long in the tooth, leather-lunged Lois. I'm sure your mother is a better soul than me.
He snorted. If that's what you call it. My mother believes in no cussing, a good night's sleep, and everything in the kitchen decorated with little ducks.
And how do you know I don't believe in those things?
I seen your kitchen.
Hey, look, I can do this. She took a tiny gulp of cigarette smoke, but mostly vamped with it dangling from her fingertips, draping her arm over the top of her head. How old is Lois, if you don't think she'd mind my asking?
She's, let me think. He looked at the ceiling.
I think she's, like, around 41 or 2. Aunt Mary Edna's a whole bunch older than her. She's, like, 50-something. That's about what I thought, the magnificent eldest. And Emmeline is between them?
Yeah, Aunt Emmeline's older than Mom.
And Aunt Hanny Mavis is younger. She's not 40 yet. I know because she was lording it over Mom about being 40. And Jules, what, between your mom and Emmeline?
No, Aunt Jules the youngest one. She was right before Cole, just 2 years apart or something like that.
Jewel? Are you sure?
Yeah, she's not that old. I was just a dumb little kid when she got married. I was the ring burier. I don't even remember it that well, but they have these embarrassing pictures. Luckily, nobody gets them out anymore since Uncle Shell ran off with that waitress. Oh, yeah, lucky thing that was. Oh, man, yuck, 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 he smacked his head, causing Lucy to giggle. She felt lightheaded on a nicotine rush, though it was the conversation, too, the company making her giddy. The last time she'd talked this long with a 17-year-old boy, she'd probably been in the back of a car. She sobered some, though, to think of Jewel. Not about Shell's running off, about Jewel's being 30 and looking 50. I thought that was right, that she was younger, but lately I was wondering, she looks older. She's the littlest sister, though. My mom and them were always jealous of her growing up because of Cole. He was everybody's favorite, right? And him and Jewel were like inseparable best friends. Oh, Lucy said, taking this in. And then I came along, so they could all resent me instead. They don't, Aunt Lucy. But they do. You don't have to pretend. He looked at her, seeming just in that moment more man than boy, as if he understood pain. She felt her heart stir again, but it wasn't desire, she realized, just a kind of love for who he might someday become. She could see how he would be with a girlfriend, sweet and in charge. Exactly like Cole at 17, probably. She leaned against the barn wall beside him, tilting her head back against the planks, both of them facing out the doorway into the evening, content for a minute to be just where they were. The surface of the pond was the color of blood oranges. So, he said.
So?
So, you run your ad. People start showing up to dump off their goats, starting with me. You can have my two.
Thank you, she said.
And then what? What are you going to do with your 500 goats?
This ends Disc 5.